Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at the med school here at the U of I. And every other month, she is here on the program. It's always on a Monday to talk about women's health. Now, she usually comes prepared with a couple of things to talk about that perhaps are new in her field. But also, we are here to answer questions as we do when we have physicians on the program. The one caveat always we mention at the beginning of the program is to listeners to do keep in mind, of course, that we can't do a diagnosis over the phone because the doctor can't see you. But this is a place that you can start, ask some basic questions, get some basic answers, and then if you have concerns, obviously you want to pursue those with your own physician. I always say at the beginning of the program, I don't want to discourage anybody from calling, but I also want to make sure people know the limitations of the format. That's all. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And that's toll-free. Anywhere you're listening, you can use that. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
I feel that I haven't seen you in a very long time.
I know. From once a month to every other month.
It does seem like a long time.
I don't know. So many news stories that I put in my little pile from after my last show seems so long ago by the time I look at them. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, okay.
But I do have a few stories.
Well, let's start in, though. What have you brought to talk about?
Well, I thought the most dramatic, that was a story that came out of Reuters Health, which is a very reliable news source from a study that the Mayo Clinic released just on the 23rd of January, that women who undergo even taking out one ovary or both their ovaries prior to the age of menopause, so this is women whom may have a premature menopause because of this, are at an increased risk of the disease Parkinsonism. Mm-hmm. So very odd study in some respects. And I haven't had a chance since I read this study to search out some of the more complicated neurologic issues. So if the questions get too tricky for me in the area of neurology, we're going to have to refer ourselves to a neurologist. But we've known for many years that animal studies have shown that estrogen can be somewhat neuroprotective. So if we have looked at our estrogen exposure to rat brain cells in a dish, we know that those brain cells will have more branches out, and the branches then form branches, and the branches from cell to cell start connecting with each other, and they're more neurotransmitters. So we've talked about this a lot with the Women's Health Initiative, that one of the things that we look at clinically is whether or not estrogen can protect you against Alzheimer's or cause Alzheimer's and give you better memory or give you worse memory. Mm-hmm. We know that women who have night sweats can't sleep as well. And we know that people who don't sleep as well get mood and memory problems. So a lot of researchers argued that some of the neurologic findings in menopause were not due to the estrogen effect on the brain. It was due to this lack of sleep problem. So things are very complicated when it comes to the brain. No surprise. But there's also been some animal studies that say that estrogen can be protective of this, what's called the nigrostriol pathway. And this is the pathway of our brain that controls some of the motor functions. And if you remember, people with Parkinsonism get that loss of fine motor control. And don't ask me any more than that. It's about as good as I get it. And so to provide some insult, they looked at women and they did what's called a case control study, and they matched women of similar age up. And they said they looked at surgeries in women that were done for things other than for cancer. So they did exclude cancer cases to try to weed out some of the confounding variables, and they said that the risk of Parkinsonism was increased with what they call a hazard ratio of 1.68. Now, if we look at the way these numbers are interpreted, we say the average risk of the average patient would be one. So when you talk about, say, smoking and lung cancer, your chance of getting lung cancer for the average American would be one. And then if you smoke, you increase your risk to up to about 9, 10. I've seen studies 13. I've seen studies as low as 5. That's a really huge increase in risk. When we talk about Women's Health Initiative and the risks of inducing breast cancer from estrogens, we talk about a 20% increase, or we talk about real rates of growing approximately 1 to 2 extra breast cancers per 1,000 women per year. And they talk about a hazard ratio of something like 1.2 or 1.3 in that range. So this is a hazard ratio of 1.68. So pretty robust, stronger than what we usually quote patients as the risk of estrogen-induced breast cancers, but not near as robust as your chance of getting lung cancer from smoking. So that kind of puts it a little bit. And it said that they thought that the premature estrogen deficiency robs the neurons, the pathways of the nerves in the brain, of protective benefits associated with the hormone, therefore raising the risk of Parkinson's and other neurologic disorder. And it was one of the first to support a hypothesis of a critical age window for protective effect of estrogen on the nigrostriatal pathway in humans. And however, independent replication of our findings is needed before they can be considered guiding gynecologic practices. When I was in medical school and when I was a resident and for many years of practice, we used to sort of use the cutoff of age 50. So at 50, we would tell women that your lifetime risk of ovarian cancer is about 1 in 70. And if you were thinking about having a hysterectomy at age 50, it would be reasonable to prophylactically remove your ovaries to prevent ovarian cancer. And under the age of 40, you would have at least 10 years more of ovarian function. And that under the age of 40, we would always recommend that women would keep their ovaries. And between 40 and 50 was sort of our gray zone. Let's consider all the factors depending on the case. And more recently, we've reanalyzed that factor, and given that ovarian removal also has consequences on your bones and your cardiac system, and given, I'm sure you've seen, we've had recent literature about problems with the statins and the Vitorin and some of the, you know, is this going to protect us against heart disease? So we've been recently urged to use the cutoff of age 65 for ovarian removal if a woman was going to have a hysterectomy. Now, I do also want to point out to women, and if anybody is, you know, fortunately, hysterectomies aren't that common, although there are something like 750,000 hysterectomies done in the United States each year. But having your ovaries removed does not completely protect you against having ovarian cancer. About 2 to 3% of all cases of ovarian cancers are in women who've had ovarian removal. So it's not completely protective, but very protective at any rate. So I think this is another piece of evidence that would lean us towards setting that elective ovarian removal older and older.
Well, now, if you had a woman come into your office who said, well, I had my ovaries removed and I had them removed before menopause, you would probably say, well, okay, we've got one study. You probably don't want to do anything just because you've only got one study. But supposing she says, well, what would you suggest that I do anything.
Well, and this is where I think there's been so much confusion. I think a lot of patients self-remove themselves from hormone replacement therapy after the Women's Health Initiative. And I think we need to separate out patients who were truly on quote-unquote replacement therapy. In other words, the premenopausal patient who lost her ovaries prior to the natural age of menopause and who really probably does need that estrogen protection of her heart, of her bones, now maybe of her brain as well, until she would have reached the natural age of menopause, from someone who now is considering therapeutic replacement, treatment of hot flashes, treatment of, for whatever reason, a deficiency of estrogen that has now produced symptoms, lack of sexuality, painful intercourse, bladder dysfunction, osteoporosis that may or may not have responded to other therapies, or maybe you can't take other therapies. So I think we need, again, to separate out those two groups. And you're right. This is one more piece of evidence where you need to sit down and say, okay, you're 40 and you lost your ovaries at 30, and now we have a lot of evidence that maybe you still need some estrogen to be protective of your heart, your bones, your brain. Let's think about 10 years more of estrogen and then think about other ways to, other therapies for your menopause after that.
So it would have been common practice if you had a woman of that age who had her ovaries removed, was a long time until menopause, that you would be doing estrogen replacement?
Generally,
that would be your,
generally, yes. And again, depends on where you had your surgery. If you had your surgery in Canada or the southern part of the United States, it was also very proactive to supplement with testosterone as well as estrogen, because the female ovary is your source of testosterone, a lot of your source of sexuality. Many women post ovarian removal or post menopause find themselves testosterone deficient and not functioning sexually. We have no female sexuality therapies in the United States. We got a whole list for you guys. Not casting any aspersions on my moderator here, but
thank you very much.
You know, as the male spokesperson out there, should he ever feel like he needs a prescription, he's got all kinds of choices. But we have no therapies, and in Europe, they have already passed the entrance of the testosterone patch that we were part of the trial on, and we are still part of the Procter & Gamble Embrace trials on the Intrinsa patch for sexuality. We're going to be starting a new trial on a testosterone gel, so we're hoping for some success for successful testosterone supplementation for our patients. But there are ways of getting synthetic testosterones to our patients, or compounded testosterones. But I'm sure you were aware in the past month, the FDA came out very strongly against compounding mm-hmm. medications.
Mm-hmm. We have as our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troupin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine, and once a month is on this program. No, it used to be once a month. Now it's every other month. Maybe we should go back to once a month. We'll talk about that later. She's here. We talk about women's health. It's your opportunity to call in and ask questions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to stay with this for a second, what would have been the main reasons in a woman who was, say, 30 to have her ovaries removed?
Excellent question. Perhaps infection, perhaps pain, perhaps endometriosis, and probably endometriosis being the number one cause. Definitive surgery for endometriosis has always been complete hysterectomy as well as bilateral salpingophorectomy. Again, in the United States, we don't have very good therapies for endometriosis. The number one treatment that we use is either recurrent surgeries like laparoscopies or the GnRH agonist Lupron. Lupron is a therapy that's approved for 6 months of use. It's an injection, very strong medication, many side effects, and expensive medication. Really not an affordable medication if you don't have insurance, and some insurance companies still have very high copays for Lupron as a medication. It also has some intrinsic problems with it as a medication because as an agonist, it gives you an estrogen boost before it shuts down the estrogen production. And to control endometriosis, you want to shut down estrogen production. So gynecologic research is really madly trying to come up with a better endometriosis treatment so that we can save premenopausal ovaries. And the areas of research for endometriosis have been using a lower dose of Depo-Provera. I think we've talked about the consequences of long-term Depo-Provera use. It causes some suppression of estrogen. So there's now a new approved 104 dose that gives less estrogen suppression. Reformulating the gold standard drug danazole to be able to be used vaginally so that you don't have the male hormone systemic side effects and that you get a really good level to the areas of the body where the lesions are. And we have actually one clinical trial going on with that. There finally are some clinical trials. I believe they're just publishing the results with a drug that we did work on that's a GnRH antagonist, so that it has a couple of benefits. Number one, it's a pill instead of an injection, but also it immediately shuts down the pituitary production of the hormone that stimulates estrogen production out of the ovaries. So that's a drug on the pipeline. And now we have drugs that I've nicknamed sperms, but they're selective progesterone receptor modulator, SPRM, or something. It's kind of a sperm. But at any rate, and we're just beginning trials with those medication. With that medication, we have actually done some work with a similar medicine that's used to shrink fibroids. It's another area of medicine where we have problems. Uterine fibroids, number one cause of probably getting a hysterectomy. So voluntary ovarian removal premenopausally usually probably accompanies fibroids. But anyway, endometriosis, to answer your question succinctly, probably, and pain is probably one of the reasons. A very young person, large ovarian cysts, or even in some patients, cysts are large enough that even if you try to save small pieces of the ovary, what pieces left may not function fully for the entire life of the ovary. Mm.
And if you are going to do a hysterectomy, and if ovarian function, their condition seems to be fine, you don't have a family history of ovarian cancer, you don't have any reason to suspect that there's any particular problem with the ovaries. How common is it, if you're going to do the hysterectomy, to go ahead and also remove the ovaries?
Well, again, it would depend on the age of the patient and the request of the patient and type of hysterectomy performed and so forth. But I would say that in the menopausal age range, it's very common to remove the ovaries. Mm-hmm. In the premenopausal range, much less common, but again, as you get older, over the age of 40, still quite common. But the trend has been amongst board-certified obstetrician gynecologists to push that age up older and older and encourage patients to keep their ovaries. But it's interesting because this study says even removing one ovary, so even somebody who had say a borderline ovarian tumor, they excluded cancer patients in this. It'd be kind of interesting to see if they do a reanalysis with cancer patients, see if they had anything different. But they, even losing one ovary was something significant. So if you had hemorrhage or a ruptured cyst or did lose an ovary, for some reason, you were still at greater risk.
So you said something earlier. Let me ask you about it. You said that you could have your ovaries removed, or you could have no ovaries, but you could still have ovarian cancer.
Yes.
You said, so how
How does this happen
if well, you don't have ovaries?
There's probably a variety of ways that this happens. First of all, we assume that in some cases, a very stuck down endometriosis or case like that, there may be microscopic fragments that literally were never removed. So there may be that. We also know that in fetal life, the ovaries start their career closer to the kidney and they sort of migrate to their final position. So we think of it as sort of microscopic droppings of the tissue that may exist. We don't know if somehow technically in the performance of the oophorectomy there may be problems. We don't know if maybe there are literally some cases where we just don't have the right diagnosis, that somebody thought she lost both her ovaries, but she really only had the capsule left or something like that. So there could be a variety of reasons.
Okay. Again, we're inviting questions. We're getting close to the midpoint here. Our guest is OBGYN Dr. Suzanne Troopen. If you have questions about women's health, she is here every other month, and I know her would do her best to give you an answer, help you out. If there's something you'd like to discuss, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, what else would you like to talk about?
Well, the FDA did release a statement, I believe it was a bit ago, where they did talk about spermicides and sort of issued a little bit of a warning. And they are now requiring makers of contraceptive gels to state that these products do not protect against sexually transmitted diseases, including AIDS. Now, we have always told our patients that that we actually feel that if they got a good enough concentration, that there would be some protection against sexually transmitted diseases if they use the products that are contain nonoxynol 9, because they have shown that this ingredient does, in certain concentration, is a virucide and a bactericide. But they say that standalone products will not protect you. You must use them with a condom in order to be protected. And they also state that because they can be a little bit irritating to those tissues, that you might actually have an increased chance of getting HIV and AIDS, and they got that from studies in Africa and some places. So they did issue this warning, and so for patients using barrier methods to protect themselves against STDs, can't just use the film or the creams or the gels. You have to accompany it with a condom.
All right. We have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation here. Someone who is listening in McLean County and on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. I have several questions, but I'll see if I can keep them short for you. Number one is I'm on Prempro, and I'm taking it, and I miss your very beginning. I'm taking it because of sleep. Because I could not sleep until I started taking it, I can tell a difference. I'm in the lowest dose, that's that 0.3 something, and I was thinking about increasing to the 0.45. How much of a difference is it in terms of increasing chances of breast cancer due to that? Because, you know, I mean, I'm really scared to even move that much. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, There's not been a long-term head-to-head study comparing the risk of breast cancer in the 0.3 to the 0.45 dose of those two medications, and the risk-benefit ratio of those two medications should be very, very similar. We know that the risks of breast cancer for those medications is low and should continue low over time. One new test that we now have available, although I did buy the first machine in Illinois, so available is a little bit of a term that isn't so available, but it's very affordable. It's called the Halo Breast PAP. And one thing that's very interesting about this PAP is it's a medical grade breast pump that actually tries to obtain nipple aspirate fluid. And if we obtain fluid, it sends it off for a pap to look and see if they're actual breast cells. And if they're breast cells, if those cells have undergone precancerous changes, so that hopefully we can identify the patients that have started to undergo the precancerous changes that are the patients that are going to become the population that will get the early breast cancers. So with this Halo Breast Pap, we will be able to detect breast cancers in years 1 to 6, 1 to 8, whereas even mammograms only pick up breast cancers in years 8 to 12. So I think with patients on estrogens, they have to be very vigilant about their mammograms, about their clinical breast exams. And I think that is what it is safe to do. We think that over time that everybody should use the lowest effective dose for the shortest period of time. If you're taking estrogen therapy, it should be effective. So you shouldn't be afraid in consultation with your physician to get on the dose that is effective.
Right.
And the differences are going to be small.
Okay. Now, I heard you say something about how long to take it. Because it really actually, the reason I'm taking it is not because of hot flashes, anything else. The only reason that I clearly seem to have great use for is sleep, because my sleep just was horrible. All I do is lay down and see bright, bright lights and couldn't fall asleep, and pretty much spent a year not sleeping at all. How long could I stay on something like this? I mean, I know you say short, so when will I ever get to a point where I can do without the Prempro?
Most of the studies agree that that 5 years is pretty much considered short-term therapy by all the physicians. And whether 10 years is still short or 20 years is still short is pretty much open to discussion. So 5 years, always considered short. And then at some point in the future, most patients can be tapered off, but many patients will not be able to be tapered off. And that's not something that we can just answer at this point in time. First, most patients need to become therapeutic. Then they need to spend some time being successfully treated. And then at some point in the future, their own clinician needs to decide if they still are going to be best managed by that medicine and when's going to be the right time to either decrease their dose or to get them off completely.
A question in terms of sleep, you know, just in menopause, general question, is that really common?
Sleep disorders are very common in our population. Probably in the 1920s, the average sleep of the average American was 9.2 hours, and the average American now sleeps about 6.1 hours. Mm-hmm. So sleep disorders are pretty common amongst all of us, and right. They are exacerbated by menopausal symptoms, and they are exacerbated by a variety of other things. Having appropriate sleep hygiene does help, and at times, you do need just a consultation from a sleep therapist, and that has helped a number of my patients. And there are other therapies that have been tried. I was actually in a study with Lunesta, strictly looking at Lunesta for menopausal sleep problems, and it was actually very successful. There are some other data showing that other menopausal therapies can work for sleep as well. We were in a study with one of the antidepressants for, it was a menopausal symptom study, but patients had sleep improvement as well.
Okay. I'm going to give you a couple more questions and I'm going to hang up if you don't mind. And if you can cover it, fine. If not, and that was one about vitamin D. I just heard something on the news within the last couple of weeks about vitamin, if you take too much vitamin D, it causes blah, blah, blah. And I literally turned my mind off because I'm like, I don't want to hear one more thing you can or can't do anymore. Number two was all the TV ads about Fosamax and the lockjaw problem. If you can kind of address those in terms of basically bone health, I'd appreciate it. And thank you very, very much.
Sure. Well, okay.
Well, let me talk about Fosamax and vitamin D together briefly. So Fosamax is one of the more commonly prescribed bisphosphonates. Bisphosphonates treat about 85% of the 8 million Americans that have either osteopenia or osteoporosis, and they're fabulous drugs. Compliance is a problem. So anything that you can do to reduce your number of health behaviors and do something less, so the once a month medication, also Bandrenate actually also comes as a 4 times a year infusion. We also do now have the newer medication that comes as a once a year infusion. So the zoledronic acid. So there are many good alternatives, although Fosamax is going generic next month, February. I was about to say this month. This month's almost this month. So that's going to be an excellent alternative. In about 1 in 10,000 cases, osteonecrosis of the jaw can occur. There's also been a joint FDA did issue a new warning about all bisphosphonates can cause some muscle and joint pains. And if anybody is having these joint pains, they should report these to their physician. And they usually do resolve right when you get off the medication. You have to have proper levels of vitamin D and calcium. And I see too many patients that haven't been properly worked up and don't have a blood calcium or vitamin D level taken. You also have to have working kidneys to be safely taking these medications. So some quick lab work to establish where you are with your vitamin D and calcium level and your kidney function is probably indicated if you're going to take these medicines. Then from there, where you need to supplement up to a point where you're not going to get too high. But with vitamin D, generally speaking, the requirements are now more than what we used to have. We are currently enrolling a trial looking for osteoporotic women ages 55 to 80 with looking at Actonel, looking at some newer formulations. And so if somebody wants 2 years of free medicine, wants to be paid to participate, we'd love to hear from you. But there are some problems with taking these medicines because they're not absorbed all that well. So it does take some very careful monitoring and intense supervision. And I think with doing that is where you should go. These reports over the media can be a little bit confusing.
And I think that the other question, and I'm thinking that maybe it was that because there have been some studies, some concerns about some people taking Fosamax, developing this really serious degenerative bone condition in the jaw.
Osteonecrosis of the jaw, 1 in 10,000, been reported with every single one, primarily in cancer patients or patients with who are going to undergo dental procedure, pre-existing dental conditions. Yeah.
So it's not something that but every
there was just a new publication that I heard about Friday night, but you've caught me before I had a chance to look it up, and saying that actually dental procedures fare better if you're already on Fosamax, but I have to look up that publication because I'm going to love it because so many dentists were taking patients off their medicine they needed.
Let's talk next with someone in Savoy. This is line number 2. Hello.
Okay, I want to get back to hormones. Would this new medicine called Libigel eventually become some form of replacement therapy for women?
It's definitely the FDA has urged us to move from the terminology hormone replacement therapy to hormone therapy. So we're looking at it in menopausal patients who would not normally be given therapeutic levels of testosterone, and we are looking at whether or not Libigel would be an actual successful treatment for the symptom of hypoactive sexual desire disorder. But once we do the trial, analyze the data, we'll see if it's appropriate to go to FDA and make it to market.
Are you doing some of that study?
Yes.
Oh, how many places across the country are doing that?
Well, off the top of my head, I don't remember how many. I don't remember how many investigators are in this study, but a group all across the country.
How long has it been going on?
There have been a number of trials of Libigel, and this particular study, there are going to be a couple of different branches we're just undergoing, but it is a study of menopausal females, and if you know a menopausal female that is interested in participating, we'd be happy to sit down with her and get her the information. We're just beginning to enroll the trial.
And what phase or study or whatever it's called is this?
And I would be able to discuss that with her, but I really probably can't go into all of that on the phone, but I'm sorry.
Okay.
And just there are some potential undesirable side effects from taking testosterone. Do you lessen your potential side effects if you're using a different delivery method and you're not taking it orally?
Well, there's no doubt that any transdermal application of hormones avoids what we call the first pass effect, where you get if you swallow a hormone, you get what's called a first pass effect. So you get a big boost of that hormone into the liver, and that more dramatically impacts the liver itself in terms of our clotting factors and our other enzymes. So we think that you have a little bit stronger effect on the liver. Now, you got to remember that the contraceptive patch just had an FDA warning about clot risk because it got so much better blood level it is transdermal, it's across the skin, but it's such a consistent release that it gets a better blood level that it has that effect on the liver to have a slightly increased rate of raising the clotting factors relative to taking a pill. So there are other factors, but definitely the route of delivery affects the effectiveness.
Yeah. Just one thing in particular, I guess, that I have seen that there is as a potential contraindication for testosterone is if somebody has high risk factors for heart disease or has high cholesterol.
Well, yes,
you don't want to do that.
Well, because the testosterone can affect the liver, which is where the cholesterol is produced. And also testosterone primarily gets converted to estrogens. So one thing that we have to look at is the effects on the breast and whether there are going to be any long-term effects on the breast. So it may have some beneficial effects, but we have to look at whether or not there are going to be any negative effects.
Let's talk with someone in Mattoon. This is line one. Hello. Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Troopin.
Hello.
I'm concerned about my skin. I'm 42 years old, and I'm a little bit premenopausal, and I'm really starting to see a lot of changes in my skin, particularly it's just sort of rough, and I'm noticing a lot more lines. I feel like the elasticity is really starting to come out of my skin. And one of my girlfriends mentioned a couple of different things to me. She said Botox might work, but I'm concerned. Is it safe? Is it appropriate for what I'm going through? And is there anything else that you would recommend that I look at to help me during this time in my change?
Well, absolutely excellent questions. As we get older, we've talked before, of course, sun, and I think David had dermatologist sun, and all they say is sun, 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 sun. So getting the appropriate skin regimen is first, and either talking to a dermatologist or a skin consultant and getting on some regimen you can live with. So if you've been doing nothing for your skin, we usually start simple. So medical grade sunscreen, and getting some antioxidant, protective something to halt what damage is going to be happening. And it can't completely halt, but start to reverse much of the damage. And then look at maybe some of the products that can start to reverse most patients if they get their skin analyzed. Of course, I'm not looking at you over our, well, one of these days we'll probably have the little camera and the little discussions, but this is only over radio. But many patients, in addition to the changes in elasticity, they're looking at some sagginess. They're looking at the little line that occurs in between their eyebrows. But we're looking at some of the blotchiness and some of the red and some of the fine lines as well. And that can start being corrected by even a product with something like retinol. So maybe a three-stepper would be about as much as I would say to begin with. CNA Ferulic has been the gold standard as a SkinCeutical product for many, many years. I turn on the evening news when I was, you know, at a meeting in Chicago, and I heard a dermatologist on their evening news saying this has always been the gold standard. Vitamin C is a very potent antioxidant, can start help reversing those changes. Now, the dermatology companies have given it a sort of what we call the ORCA score. It has an ORCA score of something like 1900, so very potent antioxidant. And now we've started getting into some of these other areas of the antioxidants that we think have even more potent ORCA scores. So Revale skin line with coffee berry, the coffee bean actually comes in a fruit, and that fruit that they peel off to then send us the beans. Well, it turns out the coffee workers had really nice hands, and they discovered an extract and got it made into a skin cream, and an actual pharmaceutical company makes it. They discovered that coffee berry, 1% coffee berry, has an ORCA score of 17,000. So really, it has actual medical potential, not that some of the over-the-counter products don't, but often to make some profits, they don't really have enough of any one thing, like Provage Medical Grade with the Edibidone, which breaks me out. But it was being sold in doctor's office, 2%, same price. Go into, you know, a department store, 1%, same price. And that's the problem. They start get the profits, they start getting it down. So getting to a place that can, you know a little bit more about these products. Now, Botox itself is the botulism type A, been used for years and years and years. And it essentially is a neurotoxin. It paralyzes a nerve. Good news is, never lasts forever. Most people, 3 to 4 months. Bad news is, never lasts forever. So you got to get it redone. And whatever it does will actually reverse a process. So it'll never, whatever wrinkle is treated will never be as bad as it was going to be, but it has to be retreated. But Botox is ideal to spot treat. So if you have some frown lines, those, you know, some people call them horns, like right two lines right in between your eyebrows, getting little eyebrow lifts, getting little, like the smile lines, little spot areas being treated are very, very common. I think, I can't remember if I read it in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal. It said, nice resume, but how about some Botox? So just a little bit of a more youthful look. If you get too much Botox, particularly in certain areas, yes, frozen face look. People don't want that. If you want to reduce fine lines and wrinkling without the frozen face look, then people start getting into, how can I get back that elasticity that I had at youth? Now we're talking collagen building. That's usually done with lasers, photofacials, some of the skin treatments can do that, but that's really where you kind of get to the next level. Just to give people sort of an idea, just a spot treatment for Botox could be $200 to $300 for a small area. If you're going to do bigger areas of your face, you shouldn't be spending more than $350, $400 first time, try it out. And yes, you might have to do it every 4 to 5 months, might be every 3 months. Some people metabolize it fairly fast. You just don't know how fast you're going to metabolize it. If you're going to get into some of the skincare lines, $250, $300 should go a really long way. And like Revali Coffee Berry line can last you 4 or 5 months. And you can go into department stores, spend 2-3 times that for no effectiveness. Skincare packages with laser treatments. If you're going to do a whole resurfacing, like with a 2940, kind of erbium YAG laser, now you may be talking a $3,000 one time every 2 years. But for packages, that can be as simple as $1,500. So that gives you sort of a range, just to give you an idea. But it's actually amazing what simple things can be done with technology. The other thing that I try to tell women, as I've studied skin, as my own, I had the same problem. A little bit older, but I had the same problem. And one thing that is important is to help your treatments get into your skin. So kind of minimally just exfoliating that top layer. That's why I think Oprah put on her favorites list, that Clarisonic brush. I was surfing around from some email I got this, and I happened to notice they didn't even have them anymore. It's Sephora. They were so popular. The Clarisonic brushes that you use to exfoliate your skin. And I know that I sell them down at my Skin Spot Ada, but I know we have trouble getting them in too. But to exfoliate first before you put your products on, and that actually helps that vitamin C, helps that coffee berry. I think the newest is going to be the drug company Topex has a green tea line. I haven't tried it yet, but hopefully that helps answer. Don't give up. Yes, there's lots of progress for skin. Thanks.
Okay. Well, we
might have lost her.
Okay. Well, I think we did. I'm hoping that gets at the question well enough. And sometime soon we're going to try to have a dermatologist here on the program.
Excellent.
We try at least a couple times a year. We have three that we like
that you rotate.
And we rotate through.
Good.
And I don't think we've done our winter skin show.
You need to.
Yet, and we should
find out about all the new lash stuff. They finally have medical grade brush on to thicken your lashes. May not appeal to all the men, but it appeals to the women.
I think a lot about, but you know, the beauty of radio is that nobody can see me.
You look gorgeous. He looks great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. In the minute or two we have left, is there something else that you'd like to mention?
Oh, there's so much. Let's see. I thought I would briefly talk about stress incontinence. I have been very excited about all the progress with the meshes for bladder repair. Patients are able to have minimally invasive surgeries that get you right back to work, and they have great efficacy. So patients who used to have stress incontinence and suffer with them for long periods of time are doing so much better with them. And there are even a couple of products coming out that are even less invasive, maybe even getting put in under local. So that's been a big progress. The ablations, we were talking a lot about hysterectomies and whether or not you should keep your ovaries, but the big progress in avoiding hysterectomies have been doing ablations to burn out the lining of the uterus, and the NovaSure ablation. Do it in the office under a little bit of sedation. if the patient needs that, and local, it's 90-second treatment. But even now, larger uteruses with very irregular cavities secondary to uterine fibroids can be treated with the newer generation of the thermal choice balloon. And they're starting, some of the balloon prices are coming down, and most people get this paid for by insurance. But for some of the out-of-pocket or the medical savings plan people, that is very important. And I think those are some of the facts. I think that also we are going to look forward to many more variations in birth control pills. We are still now even doing another study on the Yasmin Yaz product family of contraceptive pills. So we're still enrolling that study if anybody's interested in participating in a contraceptive study. So that's what I brought today.
Okay.
I will see you in a couple of months.
All right. Very good. And I guess that would be, let me see, March.
March.
All right. Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I in the med school and is with us every other month on a Monday, and we talk about women's health.